This is Audible.
Blackstone Audio presents The Church by C.S. Lewis, edited by Leslie Walmsley. This book is read by Ralph Cosham. 53. Christian Reunion. An Anglican Speaks to Roman Catholics. Written at the invitation of Roman Catholic friends, this essay was discovered on the back of a few sheets of broadcasts made in 1944 after Lewis's death in 1963, and was published for the first time in Christian Reunion 1990. I have been asked to write on Christian Reunion, but I am afraid that what I have to say will amount to little more than a rough analysis of the actual disunity and a suggestion of how most of us ought to behave while our tragic and sinful divisions continue. I will begin by saying that, whether for good or ill, the nature of the disunity has changed with the centuries. It has become more strictly or clearly theological. I have been well placed for noticing this because I grew up in a very archaic society, that of Northern Ireland, amidst conditions which had even then long since passed away in England. I have thus had a glimpse of the old disunity, the kind that descended from the 16th century. In it, the strictly theological differences were hopelessly entangled with differences of nationality, class, politics, and the less essential differences of ritual. I do not suggest that all differences of ritual are unessential. They were also very embittered. A Protestant mother whose son turned from atheism to Rome, or a Roman mother whose son turned from atheism to Protestantism, would both have felt, I think, simple grief. That state of affairs has passed away. On the question of ritual, indeed, it has almost turned upside down. In southern England, the Romans are now not ritualistic enough to please the High Anglicans, and the Congregationalists may, I am told, be as high as either. Whatever the barrier now is, it is no longer a barrier of candles. Whatever the fog, it is not a fog of incense. And on the purely theological level, I think I may say that the barrier is no longer that between a doctrine of faith and a doctrine of works. I am not myself convinced that any good Roman ever did hold the doctrine of works in that form of which Protestants accused him, or that any good Protestant ever did hold the doctrine of faith in that form of which the Romans accused him. At any rate, I feel certain that no man of good will today hopes to see God either by pecca fortiter or by founding an abbey. It would still be difficult, especially in Germany, to get an agreed formula. But I think that difficulty now springs rather from the mysteriousness of the subject itself than from two clearly held and mutually exclusive doctrines. The difficulty that remains, and which becomes sharper as it becomes narrower, is our disagreement about the seat and nature of doctrinal authority. The real reason, I take it, why you cannot be in communion with us is not your disagreement with this or that particular Protestant doctrine, so much as the absence of any real doctrine, in your sense of the word, at all. It is, you feel, like asking a man to say he agrees not with a speaker, but with a debating society. And the real reason why I cannot be in communion with you is not my disagreement with this or that Roman doctrine, but that to accept your church means not to accept a given body of doctrine, but to accept in advance any doctrine your church hereafter produces. It is like being asked to agree not only to what a man has said, but to what he's going to say. To you, the real vice of Protestantism is the formless drift which seems unable to retain the Catholic truths, which loses them one by one and ends in a modernism which cannot be classified as Christian by any tolerable stretch of the word. To us, the terrible thing about Rome is the recklessness, as we hold, with which she has added to the depositum fidei, the tropical fertility, the proliferation of credenda. You see in Protestantism the faith dying out in a desert. We see in Rome the faith smothered in a jungle. I know no way of bridging this gulf, nor do I think it the business of the private layman to offer much advice on bridge-building to his betters. My only function as a Christian writer is to preach mere Christianity, not ad clerum, but ad populum. Any success that has been given me has, I believe, been due to my strict observance of those limits. By attempting to do otherwise, I should only add one more recruit, and a very ill-qualified recruit, to the ranks of the controversialists. After that, I should be no more use to anyone. I have, however, a strong premonition as to the way in which reunion will not come. It will not come at the edges. Liberal Romans and High Anglicans will not be the ones who will meet first. For the odd thing is that the nearer you get to the heart of each communion, the less you notice its difference from the other. It is important at this point that I should not be misunderstood. What I am trying to say might be interpreted to mean that doctrines don't matter, and that the essence of the spiritual life lay either in the affections or in some mystical experience to which the intelligence is simply irrelevant. I do not believe it is so. That the spiritual life transcends both intelligence and morality, we are probably all agreed. But I suppose it transcends them as poetry transcends grammar, and does not merely exclude them as algebra excludes grammar. I should distrust the mysticism to which they ever became simply irrelevant. That is not the way in which the divisions grow less important at the center. To the very last, when two people differ in doctrine, logic proclaims that though both might be in error, it is impossible for both to be right. And error always, to some extent, disables. When, therefore, we find a certain heavenly unity existing between really devout persons of differing creeds, a mutual understanding and even a power of mutual edification which each may lack towards a lukewarm member of his own denomination, we must ascribe this to the work of Christ, who, in the erroneous one, sterilizes his errors and inhibits the evil consequences they would naturally have. If ye drink any deadly thing, it shall not hurt you, Mark chapter 16, verse 18, and opens the eyes of the other party to all the truths mingled in his friend's errors, which are, of course, likely to be truths he particularly needs. 54. Priestesses in the Church. Originally published as Notes on the Way in Time and Tide, Volume 29, 14th of August 1948, and reproduced in Undeceptions, 1971, this is now in God in the Dock, 1998. I should like balls infinitely better, said Caroline Bingley, if they were carried on in a different manner. It would surely be much more rational if conversation instead of dancing made the order of the day. A much more rational, I dare say, replied her brother, but it would not be near so much like a ball. We are told that the lady was silenced. Yet it could be maintained that Jane Austen has not allowed Bingley to put forward the full strength of his position. He ought to have replied with a distinguo. In one sense, conversation is more rational, for conversation may exercise the reason alone, dancing does not. But there is nothing irrational in exercising other powers than our reason. On certain occasions, and for certain purposes, the real irrationality is with those who will not do so. The man who would try to break a horse, or write a poem, or beget a child by pure syllogizing, would be an irrational man. Although at the same time, syllogizing is, in itself, a more rational activity than the activities demanded by these achievements. It is rational not to reason, or not to limit oneself to reason in the wrong place. And the more rational a man is, the better he knows this. These remarks are not intended as a contribution to the criticism of Pride and Prejudice. They came into my head when I heard that the Church of England was being advised to declare women capable of priests' orders. I am, indeed, informed that such a proposal is very unlikely to be seriously considered by the authorities. To take such a revolutionary step at the present moment, to cut ourselves off from the Christian past, and to widen the divisions between ourselves and other churches by establishing an order of priestesses in our midst, would be an almost wanton degree of imprudence. And the Church of England herself would be torn in shreds by the operation. My concern with the proposal is of a more theoretical kind. The question involves something even deeper than a revolution in order. I have every respect for those who wish women to be priestesses. I think they are sincere and pious and sensible people. Indeed, in a way they are too sensible. That is where my descent from them resembles Bingley's descent from his sister. I am tempted to say that the proposed arrangement would make us much more rational, but not near so much like a church. For at first sight, all the rationality, in Caroline Bingley's sense, is on the side of the innovators. We are short of priests. We have discovered in one profession after another that women can do very well all sorts of things which were once supposed to be in the power of men alone. No one among those who dislike the proposal is maintaining that women are less capable than men of piety, zeal, learning, and whatever else seems necessary for the pastoral office. What, then, except prejudice begotten by tradition, forbids us to draw on the huge reserves which could pour into the priesthood if women were here, as in so many other professions, put on the same footing as men? And against this flood of common sense, the opposers, many of them women, can produce, at first, nothing but an inarticulate distaste, a sense of discomfort which they themselves find it hard to analyze. That this reaction does not spring from any contempt for women is, I think, plain from history. The Middle Ages carried their reverence for one woman to a point at which the charge could plausibly be made that the Blessed Virgin became in their eyes almost a fourth person of the Trinity. But never, so far as I know, in all those ages was anything remotely resembling a sacerdotal office attributed to her. All salvation depends on the decision which she made in the words Ecce Ancilla. She is united in 9 months' inconceivable intimacy with the Eternal Word. She stands at the foot of the cross, John chapter 19, verse 25. But she is absent both from the Last Supper, Matthew chapter 26, verse 26, Mark chapter 14, verse 22, Luke chapter 22, verse 19, and from the descent of the Spirit at Pentecost. Acts chapter 2, verse 1. Such is the record of Scripture. Nor can you daff it aside by saying that local and temporary conditions condemned women to silence and private life. There were female preachers. One man had four daughters who all prophesied, i.e., preached. Acts chapter 21, verse 9. There were prophetesses even in Old Testament times. Prophetesses, not priestesses. At this point, the common sensible reformer is apt to ask why, if women can preach, they cannot do all the rest of a priest's work. This question deepens the discomfort of my side. We begin to feel that what really divides us from our opponents is a difference between the meaning which they and we give to the word priest. The more they speak, and speak truly, about the competence of women in administration, their tact and sympathy as advisers, their natural talent for visiting, the more we feel that the central thing is being forgotten. To us, a priest is primarily a representative, a double representative, who represents us to God and God to us. Our very eyes teach us this in the church. Sometimes the priest turns his back on us and faces the east. He speaks to God for us. Sometimes he faces us and speaks to us for God. We have no objection to a woman doing the first. The whole difficulty is about the second. But why? Why should a woman not in this sense represent God? Certainly not because she is necessarily, or even probably, less holy or less charitable or stupider than a man. In that sense, she may be as godlike as a man, and a given woman much more so than a given man. The sense in which she cannot represent God will perhaps be plainer if we look at the thing the other way round. Suppose the reformer stops saying that a good woman may be like God and begins saying that God is like a good woman. Suppose he says that we might just as well pray to our Mother which art in heaven as to our Father. Suppose he suggests that the Incarnation might just as well have taken a female as a male form, and the second person of the Trinity be as well called the daughter as the son. Suppose, finally, that the mystical marriage were reversed, that the church were the bridegroom and Christ the bride. All this, as it seems to me, is involved in the claim that a woman can represent God as a priest does. And now it is surely the case that if all these supposals were ever carried into effect, we should be embarked on a different religion. Goddesses have, of course, been worshipped. Many religions have had priestesses. but they are religions quite different in character from Christianity. Common sense, disregarding the discomfort or even the horror which the idea of turning all our theological language into the feminine gender arouses in most Christians, will ask, why not? Since God is in fact not a biological being and has no sex, what can it matter whether we say he or she, father or mother, son or daughter? But Christians think that God himself has taught us how to speak of him. To say that it does not matter is to say either that all masculine imagery is not inspired, is merely human in origin, or else that, though inspired, it is quite arbitrary and unessential. And this is surely intolerable. Or, if tolerable, it is an argument not in favour of Christian priestesses, but against Christianity. It is also surely based on a shallow view of imagery. Without drawing upon religion, we know from our poetical experience that image and apprehension cleave closer together than common sense is here prepared to admit. That a child who had been taught to pray to a mother in heaven would have a religious life radically different from that of a Christian child. And as image and apprehension are in an organic unity, so, for a Christian, are human body and human soul. The innovators are really implying that sex is something superficial, irrelevant to the spiritual life. To say that men and women are equally eligible for a certain profession is to say that for the purposes of that profession, their sex is irrelevant. We are, within that context, treating both as neuters. As the state grows more like a hive or an anthill, it needs an increasing number of workers who can be treated as neuters. This may be inevitable for our secular life. But in our Christian life, we must return to reality. There we are not homogeneous units, but different and complementary organs of a mystical body. A lady in Nunbenholm has claimed that the equality of men and women is a Christian principle. I do not remember the text in Scripture, nor the Fathers, nor Hooker, nor the Prayer Book, which asserts it. But that is not here my point. The point is that unless equal means interchangeable, equality makes nothing for the priesthood of women. And the kind of equality which implies that the equals are interchangeable, like counters or identical machines, is, among humans, a legal fiction. It may be a useful legal fiction, but in church we turn our back on fictions. One of the ends for which sex was created was to symbolize to us the hidden things of God. One of the functions of human marriage is to express the nature of the union between Christ and the Church. We have no authority to take the living and seminal figures which God has painted on the canvas of our nature and shift them about as if they were mere geometrical figures. This is what common sense will call mystical. Exactly. The Church claims to be the bearer of a revelation. If that claim is false, then we want not to make priestesses, but to abolish priests. If it is true, then we would expect to find in the Church an element which unbelievers will call irrational, and which believers will call supra-rational. There ought to be something in it opaque to our reason, though not contrary to it, as the facts of sex and sense on the natural level are opaque. And that is the real issue. The Church of England can remain a church only if she retains this opaque element. If we abandon that, if we retain only what can be justified by standards of prudence and convenience at the bar of enlightened common sense, then we exchange revelation for that old wraith, natural religion. It is painful, being a man, to have to assert the privilege or the burden which Christianity lays upon my own sex. I am crushingly aware how inadequate most of us are in our actual and historical individualities to fill the place prepared for us. But it is an old saying in the army that you salute the uniform, not the wearer. Only one wearing the masculine uniform can, provisionally until the parousia, represent the Lord to the Church. For we are all, corporately and individually, feminine to him. We men may often make very bad priests. That is because we are insufficiently masculine. It is no cure to call in those who are not masculine at all. A given man may make a very bad husband. You cannot mend matters by trying to reverse the roles. He may make a bad male partner in a dance. The cure for that is that men should more diligently attend dancing classes. Not that the ballroom should henceforth ignore distinctions of sex and treat all dances as neuter. That would, of course, be eminently sensible, civilized, and enlightened, but, once more, not near so much like a ball. And this parallel between the church and the ball is not so fanciful as some would think. The church ought to be more like a ball than it is like a factory or a political party. Or, to speak more strictly, they are at the circumference and the church at the centre, and the ball comes in between. The factory and the political party are artificial creations. A breath can make them as a breath has made. In them, we are not dealing with human beings in their concrete entirety, only with hands or voters. I am not, of course, using artificial in any derogatory sense. Such artifices are necessary. But because they are our artifices, we are free to shuffle, scrap, and experiment as we please. But the ball exists to stylize something which is natural, and which concerns human beings in their entirety, namely, courtship. We cannot shuffle or tamper so much. With the church, we are farther in, for there we are dealing with male and female, not merely as facts of nature, but as the live and awful shadows of realities utterly beyond our control and largely beyond our direct knowledge. Or rather, we are not dealing with them, but, as we shall soon learn if we meddle, they are dealing with us.
55. On Church Music. Published in English Church Music, Volume 19, April 1949, and written at the invitation of the editor, Leonard Blake. It was reprinted in Christian Reflections, 1998. I am a layman, and one who can boast no musical education. I cannot even speak from the experience of a lifelong churchgoer. It follows that church music is a subject on which I cannot, even in the lowest degree, appear as a teacher. My place is in the witness box. If it concerns the court to know how the whole matter appears to such as I, not only laicus, but laicissimus, I am prepared to give my evidence. I assume from the outset that nothing should be done or sung or said in church which does not aim directly or indirectly either at glorifying God or edifying the people or both. A good service may, of course, have a cultural value as well. But that is not what it exists for. Just as, in an unfamiliar landscape, a church may help me to find the points of the compass, but was not built for that purpose. These two ends, of edifying and glorifying, seem to me to be related as follows. Whenever we edify, we glorify. But when we glorify, we do not always edify. The edification of the people is an act of charity and obedience, and therefore in itself a glorification of God. But it is possible for a man to glorify God in modes that do not edify his neighbour. This fact confronted the church at an early stage in her career, in the phenomenon called speaking with tongues. In 1 Corinthians chapter 14, St. Paul points out that the man who is inspired to speak in an unknown tongue may do very well, as far as he himself is concerned, but will not profit the congregation unless his utterance can be translated. Thus glorifying and edifying may come to be opposed. And now, at first sight, to speak with unknown tongues and to sing anthems which are beyond the musical capacity of the people would seem to be very much the same kind of thing. It looks as if we ought to extend to the one the embargo which St. Paul places on the other. And this would lead to the forbidding conclusion that no church music is legitimate except that which suits the existing taste of the people. In reality, however, the parallel is not perhaps so close as it seems. In the first place, the mode after which a speech in an unknown tongue could glorify God was not, I suppose, the same as the mode after which learned music is held to do so. It is, to say the least, doubtful whether the speeches in tongues claim to glorify God by their aesthetic quality. I suppose that they glorified God, firstly, by being miraculous and involuntary, and secondly, by the ecstatic state of mind in which the speaker was. The idea behind church music is very different. It glorifies God by being excellent in its own kind, almost as the birds and flowers and the heavens themselves glorify him.
In the composition and highly trained execution of sacred music, we offer our natural gifts at their highest to God, as we do also in ecclesiastical architecture, in vestments, in glass and gold and silver, in well-kept parish accounts, or the careful organization of a social. And in the second place, the incapacity of the people to understand a foreign language and their incapacity to understand good music are not really the same. The first applies absolutely and equally, except for a lucky accident, to all the members of the congregation. The second is not equally present or equally incurable, perhaps in any two individuals. And finally, the alternative to speech in an unknown tongue was speech in a known tongue. But in most discussions about church music, the alternative to learned music is popular music, giving the people what they like and allowing them to sing or shout their old favourites. It is here that the distinction between our problem and St. Paul's seems to me to be the sharpest. That words in a known tongue might edify was obvious. Is it equally obvious that the people are edified by being allowed to shout their favourite hymns? I am well aware that the people like it. They equally like shouting Auld Lang Syne in the streets on New Year's Eve, or shouting the latest music hall song in a taproom. To make a communal familiar noise is certainly a pleasure to human beings, and I would not be thought to despise this pleasure. It is good for the lungs, it promotes good fellowship, it is humble and unaffected, it is in every way a wholesome, innocent thing, as wholesome and innocent as a pint of beer, a game of darts, or a dip in the sea. But is it, any more than these, a means of edification? No doubt it can be done, all these things can be done, eating can be done, to the glory of God. We have an apostle's word for it. The perfected Christian can turn all his humblest, most secular, most economic actions in that direction. But if this is accepted as an argument for popular hymns, it will also be an argument for a good many other things. What we want to know is whether untrained communal singing is in itself any more edifying than other popular pleasures. And of this, I, for one, am still wholly unconvinced. I have often heard this noise. I have sometimes contributed to it. I do not yet seem to have found any evidence that the physical and emotional exhilaration which it produces is necessarily, or often, of any religious relevance. What I, like many other laymen, chiefly desire in church are fewer, better, and shorter hymns, especially fewer. The case for abolishing all church music whatever thus seems to me far stronger than the case for abolishing the difficult work of the trained choir and retaining the lusty roar of the congregation. Whatever doubts I feel about the spiritual value of the first, I feel at least equally about the spiritual value of the second. The first and most solid conclusion which, for me, emerges is that both musical parties, the highbrows and the low, assume far too easily the spiritual value of the music they want. Neither the greatest excellence of a trained performance from the choir, nor the heartiest and most enthusiastic bellowing from the pews, must be taken to signify that any specifically religious activity is going on. It may be so, or it may not. Yet the main sense of Christendom, reformed and unreformed, would be against us if we tried to banish music from the church. It remains to suggest, very tentatively, the ways in which it can really be pleasing to God or help to save the souls of men. There are two musical situations on which I think we can be confident that a blessing rests. One is where a priest or an organist, himself a man of trained and delicate taste, humbly and charitably sacrifices his own aesthetically right desires and gives the people humbler and coarser fare than he would wish, in a belief, even as it may be the erroneous belief, that he can thus bring them to God. The other is where the stupid and unmusical layman humbly and patiently, and above all silently, listens to music which he cannot or cannot fully appreciate in the belief that it somehow glorifies God, and that if it does not edify him, this must be his own defect. Neither such a highbrow nor such a lowbrow can be far out of the way. To both, church music will have been a means of grace, not the music they have liked, but the music they have disliked. They have both offered, sacrificed their taste in the fullest sense. But where the opposite situation arises,
where the musician is filled with the pride of skill or the virus of emulation, and looks with contempt on the unappreciative congregation, or where the unmusical, complacently entrenched in their own ignorance and conservatism, look with restless and resentful hostility of an inferiority complex on all who would try to improve their taste, there, we may be sure, all that both offer is unblessed, and the spirit that moves them is not the Holy Ghost. These highly general reflections will not, I fear, be of much practical use to any priest or organist in devising a working compromise for a particular church. The most they can hope to do is to suggest that the problem is never a merely musical one. Where both the choir and the congregation are spiritually on the right road, no insurmountable difficulties will occur. Discrepancies of taste and capacity will, indeed, provide matter for mutual charity and humility. For us, the musically illiterate mass, the right way is not hard to discern, and as long as we stick to it, the fact that we are capable only of a confused rhythmical noise will not do very much harm, if, when we make it, we really intend the glory of God. For if that is our intention, it follows of necessity that we shall be as ready to glorify him by silence, when required, as by shouts. We shall also be aware that the power of shouting stands very low in the hierarchy of natural gifts, and that it would be better to learn to sing if we could. If anyone tries to teach us, we will try to learn. If we cannot learn, and if this is desired, we will shut up. And we will also try to listen intelligently. A congregation in this state will not complain if a good deal of the music they hear in church is above their heads. It is not the mere ignorance of the unmusical that really resists improvements. It is jealousy, arrogance, suspicion, and the wholly detestable species of conservatism which those vices engender. How far it may be politic, a part of the wisdom of the serpent, to make concessions to the old guard in a congregation, I would not like to determine. But I do not think it can be the business of the church greatly to cooperate with the modern state in appeasing inferiority complexes and encouraging the natural man's instinctive hatred of excellence. Democracy is all very well as a political device. It must not intrude into the spiritual or even the aesthetic world. The right way for the musicians is perhaps harder, and I, at any rate, can speak of it with much less confidence. But it seems to me that we must define rather carefully the way, or ways, in which music can glorify God. There is, as I hinted above, a sense in which all natural agents, even inanimate ones, glorify God continually by revealing the powers he has given them. And in that sense, we, as natural agents, do the same. On that level, our wicked actions, insofar as they exhibit our skill and strength, may be said to glorify God, as well as our good actions. An excellently performed piece of music, as a natural operation which reveals in a very high degree the peculiar powers given to man, will thus always glorify God, whatever the intention of the performers may be. But that is a kind of glorifying which we share with the dragons and great deeps, with the frosts and snows. What is looked for in us as men is another kind of glorifying, which depends on intention. How easy or how hard it may be for a whole choir to preserve that intention through all the discussions and decisions, all the corrections and disappointments, all the temptations to pride, rivalry, and ambition which precede the performance of a great work, I, naturally, do not know. But it is on the intention that all depends. When it succeeds, I think the performers are the most enviable of men, privileged, while mortals, to honour God like angels, and, for a few golden moments, to see spirit and flesh, delight and labour, skill and worship, the natural and the supernatural, all fused into that unity they would have had before the fall. But I must insist that no degree of excellence in the music, simply as music, can assure us that this paradisal state has been achieved. The excellence proves keenness, but men can be keen for natural or even wicked motives. The absence of keenness would prove that they lack the right spirit. Its presence does not prove that they have it. We must beware of the naive idea that our music can please God, as it would please a cultivated human hearer. That is like thinking, under the old law, that he really needed the blood of bulls and goats. To which an answer came, Mine are the cattle upon a thousand hills, and if I am hungry, I will not tell thee. If God, in that sense, wanted music, he would not tell us. For all our offerings, whether of music or martyrdom, are like the intrinsically worthless present of a child, which a father values indeed, but values only for the intention. This concludes the reading of The Church by C.S. Lewis, edited by Leslie Walmsley. Copyright 2000 by C.S. Lewis PTE Limited. Compilation copyright 2000 by Leslie Walmsley. This book was read by Ralph Cosham. The production and sale of the recorded version is licensed by the C.S. Lewis Company Limited and was produced in 2013 by Blackstone Audio Inc., which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio Inc. If you would like to obtain a monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. For a complete listing of our titles, visit our website at www.downpour.com. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.